putting things, putting people in touch with one another, asking if we can have such and such from so and so to give to so and so, or maybe pairing people up. I mean, one of the most successful things we did while I was there, actually, was run, and I've done it since, I've adapted it and changed it, and there's a whole Clio given over to it. We did a management training course where we tried to explicitly we tried to use a methodology, a history methodology.
Was this for heads of department?
Yeah. I know it's here because I read through it the other day. Maybe it's in Hillary's set. Developing a departmental profile.
Oh, yes. So this is trying to spread good practice, really, between different areas.
Yeah. And I think we had three sessions with sort of 3 or 4 weeks in between each, and we gave tasks. And I was also going to the Institute at the time as part of the 16 to 19 unit there. I was doing a course for myself on evaluation, so I sort of tried to put into that some of the ideas from the course that we'd to use the evaluator. So it was very much an evaluative, methodological and sort of evidence-based course. And we paired people up when they went and they reviewed each other. It's a bit like it informed quite a lot of the review process that I then went on to do, either as a, you know, it was in the context of Ofsted, but also going into Enfield. They were doing an evaluation and monitoring policy there. Mm. So it was really a helpful thing. I think we've all found, when we talk to each other, when we see each other, or, you know, we occasionally do now, we do remember that course as a very significant point in time.
Yes, it's the impression you get from inspection reports that I've looked at from the 70s is that most history departments were very informal. And leadership was just personal relationships, really. And even sharing materials was done on an ad hoc basis, depending on how well you all got on.
That's right. I think it still was what still was in the 80s.
Mm. But this is absolutely, you know, you'd recognise this today, wouldn't you? You've got how to do meetings, how to set out minutes, how to organise your staff. So it's really a precursor to the way in which people would be developed today. There's various management training, isn't there? Leading from the middle.
I think it'll probably fit in fairly, you know. Yeah. And as I say, we did it in Enfield probably 10 years later. Because I can remember asking somebody else, we invented Clapham Comprehensive, but got all the data from somewhere else. And I needed to have some more up-to-date data set out in different ways that was current at the time. So I went to a friend of mine who was a head in Newham. I got the data for her school, and so I've got all of that in sort of Mark II version. So I mean, Clio was termly, didn't come out absolutely every term, but it tried to. I had a baby in the middle of all this, actually. I went there in 83 and finished in 89, I think, and my daughter was born in 86. But I didn't take very long off. I took a term off or something, I think. And then I went back as acting inspector for 0.5 of the time.
So how did that differ from the warden's role?
Well, it's interesting. The way that happened was that when I'd gone on maternity leave, Maureen Burns, who was one of the advisory teachers for history, took over as acting warden. And she was having such a nice time, she said, with the duster. I didn't really want to come back and stop her having her year, which she would have liked. And but also the staff inspector needed a pal, and so I did 0.5. I think I actually didn't go back to work. I just went back to 0.5 for 6 months. I can't really remember. So I think she was warden while I was doing the acting inspector, and then I just carried on doing both when she finished. And the inspection, there was a programme of sort of school inspections, really, a bit Ofsted-ish.
Was it?
So very like HMI, very, very much like the HMI inspection. So they weren't sudden. Mm. People knew you were coming. And it involved lesson observations and feedback and sort of judgments, but not, you know, I don't think we graded or did all that stuff, but it was and very much advisory, really. You know, see a lesson of their choice, usually something they wanted to work on, and then, you know, you did a sort of an evaluation of what you saw, but then you were able to make some suggestions and then do some of the advisory work following it up, either yourself or pass it on to somebody else.
You talked about the sort of formal training that you that you used. Did you also have relationships with schools that were informal, so teachers could pop in, get everything they wanted, go away, and then...
Yeah, either they would ring up and arrange to come, or they just dropped in. So we were open every night until 6. If there was a course, it might be 7. But
was that term time only, or in the holidays as
well? It was technically term time only, but I worked holidays, and we just usually, in holiday time, we asked people to make an appointment so that we could make sure that we were there.
And did you particularly focus on new teachers? Or would established teachers still use it just as much?
Both. We had a really, again, never seen the like of it since, because we had the resources to do it. We could run regular half-day sessions for newly qualified teachers. We had a programme. I think we had about 8 or 10 across the year. They'd come down on a Tuesday afternoon, I think. And we could do the social science, we could staff social science and history. Whereas ever since then I've been doing geography, history, the jobs I've been. I'm trying to manage that in half a day is not great at all. But so it's dedicated to the subject. And then we had a programme of courses, some day courses, some twilight, a lot of more twilights. We had teacher group meetings after school. So we had the women in history group, for example. Mm. We had a group who were developing a mode to GCSE. Well, it was GCE and CSE, the common paper, initially. That was a very interesting initiative too. A bit like the really, really thought through that course I was just talking about, the departmental profile. The team of advisory teachers, Inspector Ian Steele, who's fantastic, a good facilitator, and me, as a team, I think worked really, really well. And creatively, and thinking through how to get to an end that we knew we wanted to get to and how we were going to do it strategically were really, really sort of momentous occasions. And departmental profile was one. The other one was in 86 when I went back. There were two things happening. One was GCSE was on the horizon, and there was development taking place. The other was the Cambridge History Project A-level, which we, Ian Colwell and I, particularly as SHP people, were participating in. But the thing that was really interesting, and had I been aware of as a teacher in the school as well, in inner London, there were two really strong camps of history teachers. And actually, never the twain met very, or seldom did the twain meet. One was a world history group, people who were teaching O-level and CSE world history. And the other was the SHP. Mm. The SHP was a very small group. I mean, there were other courses taught, don't get me wrong. There was, you know, British and there was economic and so forth. But both the world historians and the SHP felt that they were doing what was important for changing minds and attitudes in the world and relevance and so forth. Mm. And it was such a false dichotomy. It was a bit like the content versus skills, you know, arid and silly as a discussion. And it was reflected in the advisory team as well. So most of the history advisory teachers who came in had backgrounds teaching world history. Actually, James was social and economic, and then there was me with the SHP and Ian Colwell.
Mm.
And subsequently, other people, Mary Austin. And now, the thing was that the world history tradition, of course, was very comprehension-y, narrative history, dum-de-dum-de-dum. There was very little
The challenge there
evaluation.
Was coping with the vast swathes of history.
It was the traps of time.
Yeah.
And I carried on teaching A-level, actually, half day a week while I was at the centre. I used to go back to the Islington Sixth Form Centre, teach A-level. Developmentally, again, it was to support them in forging, you know, bringing in the AAB 673, actually, because that seemed to be the most interesting course, and so I carried on doing that. But anyway, what we've managed to do, the staff inspector and I, as I recall, put our heads together to think about how we would bring the advisory team together to actually appreciate each other's perspectives and get the best out of both and so forth. And that was actually fairly easily done, and I think we did it partly through critiquing textbooks and their approaches to history.
Mm.
And we had quite an interesting exercise we worked up by taking textbooks in history across time as sources, extracts, and we did an inset activity on that. And we used that all the way through, and I've used it since as well, because it worked so well, and it really dramatically showed progress, or development, let's say. But it also showed the problem with textbooks about not being prepared to actually go hook, line and sinker into doing things. They were trying to meet everybody's... So there was a critiquing of that sort. That was the way we did it. And also, there were other people in the frame who those people got to know. We all got to know very well, who we came to really respect. One was John Slater, our hero, really. I mean, he was fabulous. And he came to the centre a lot. He valued us. And it was at the time when he did his history in. It's Hipsy, really. Right. So we were in dialogue, really, over that. Mm. And in fact, I remember doing a review on it for History Today, I think it was, when it came out. It just was so helpful at the time for what we were trying to do. But just sort of going on from that, we then saw the history GCSE thing coming down the track, and we weren't going to dissuade, nor did we want to, because I've also had as a firm sort of advocate for world history, 20th century. But we did feel that it could be really improved by greater rigour in its assessment.
Mm.
And it would actually drive the teaching and learning then into a more dynamic mode. So we put on a residential, and I can't tell you when it was, although I may well be able to track back, a residential, I think it was a weekend, I think it was quite short, I think it was a week, for people who were interested in developing syllabuses, and they were still mode twos. There was potential for a mode two common CSE O level. And we had a balance of SHP teachers and who we invited them to come along, and because we made the course sound as if it was developing a mode two of anything, which it was.
Mm.
We knew what we were about, really. We wanted there to be a dialogue, contrive a dialogue between the two sets of teachers on a mutual and equal basis. And we wanted to contrive it so that the world historians... I mean, it sounds awfully devious. This is maybe in my head. but we wanted to contrive it that they felt they were making the decisions for themselves, that they weren't being taught to suck eggs by another set of teachers. So we created some activities over the 2 or 3 days that they had to do together, and it was a bit like the department, you know, contrived it so they had to move between the two or do certain things in common where we thought things would come up. And I guess we were part of the mix as well, you know, we were as much finding out and thinking about it at the time.
So were you really sort of creating, do you think, a sort of precursor of the modern world GCSE?
Yeah. We don't know that now. We didn't know that at the time. All we knew was we wanted to get the modern... if I hadn't discovered SHP in 1978 in Harrow, I'd have left teaching. I was bored to tears because everything I experienced was what I had experienced at school and what I was seeing in the classroom then. And that syllabus was tempting, you know, because of it was vast amounts of stuff. And I taught social and economic as well. I just thought, this can't be what teaching's about. Then I found the SHP and found that spoke to me. And I just thought, well, we could look at 20th century world in a similar way. And thinking about types of study and types of foci, experiences and so on and so forth. And I don't know how clearly formed that agenda was at the time, but it over the course of 2 or 3 days of this group working together, they got terribly excited and could see a way of doing it. And then a group was formed, and they set about constructing a syllabus, which was the Mode 2, which had a development study, which was colonialism over time. It had depth studies, Soviet Union, you know, classically, and very much the SHP ones in a way. But and there was yes, they did. I can't remember actually. I'd have to, and I don't know how much I've got for that. But there is a book that was written by Ian Colwell and Maureen Burns on credits. And I've got a book.
He showed. I went to see Ian last week, and he did show it me. I think.
Did he?
And Maureen Burns. Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether he would have talked about.
He didn't mention that.
No. Did he not? Because he was the SHP, if you like, examiner at the time.
Yes, tell me that. But he didn't mention this
course. Well, yeah. I think what came out of that, and it was the units and credits stuff with David Hargreaves, which you must have come across. That's where it was all coming from. They were looking at unitising and assessing. It was also fitting with the record of achievement development within ILEAD.
Yeah.
And the course was constructed. It got through, so it became a joint CSE and GCE, the Mode 2. And there were a cluster of schools doing it. And when it came to GCSE, Ian and I were both actually in the London board at the time. We were doing on the development side for the SHP GCSE. And I wonder what happened with the world now. And I can't remember. But I do know that the Mode 2 became quite significant in how GCSE went forward. So, again, there was a source paper. There was a paper too.
Yeah.
There was all of that stuff. But I guess the reason I'm sort of telling that story in this laboured way is in terms of how the centre worked, it tried to be strategic. It tried to make sure good practice was at the centre of everything. And it was really heavy on rationale, people thinking about what they were doing and why. Not telling them what to do and why, but trying to get in the wherewithal to do that.
At that time, in the 80s, the school landscape in ILEA, did that contain grammar schools still, or were they all comprehensive by that stage?
I think it was all comprehensive. But there were schools that had hung on, particularly voluntary aided, they'd hung on. There were issues around... the main issues we were dealing with, as I recall, was single... You know, it's the single-sex schools and the number of them. There was quite a lot of issues around gender and about teachers teaching in those schools and actually not, you know... Some having interesting specs, but others being very... And same thing with ethnicity as well.
Mm.
That's interesting. Do you know, I've still got my green book upstairs, which is the ILEA... It's just the telephones and addresses for all the schools and the divisions. It's really quite interesting. Yeah. Though. It's quite... I should look down there and just remind myself whether or not there were any grammar schools. I don't think so.
No, well, perhaps there weren't. But the single-sex issue and the ethnic minority issue is an interesting one.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering about participation in the centre and what types of schools participated and what didn't. Because presumably there were some schools you didn't see.
Yeah,
very
we
often.
Didn't see. That's right. It was because it was 150 secondaries. Is it 150? Yeah, and about 1,000 primaries. Primaries we didn't see huge numbers of because we only had one advisory teacher able to run a limited amount of stuff. We did see primaries, so, you know, they certainly came, and we did joint things to support the primary person as well.
But there wasn't a primary history curriculum then, so...
Oh, no, that's true.
Mm.
Well, it wasn't a secondary one particularly, except, well, de facto, yeah. Mm. But... primary was very active. The advisory teachers we had were very good, and so they did do quite a bit, but I guess they only touched, you know, maybe 20 schools or something in a year. I don't know. Mm. More maybe through a course. In the secondary sector, oh gosh, what would be really interesting would be to have, and I doubt if I do have, I used to write a report each year on, you know, how many we'd touched and what we'd done and so forth, and who'd been. You were certainly preaching to the converted a lot of the time because it was self-selecting.
Mm.
You know, there's been a lot of voluntarism. I mean, I can remember the London Oratory. Did you come across the London Oratory?
Yeah.
And they saw themselves as a grammar school, no doubt about it. And de facto were, actually. I mean, they had a selective intake. And they taught, you know, a rigorous narrative history, a didactic and so forth. And the inspector thought it would be a great, you know, benefit to do some work in there. And he persuaded the head of the department to let us go in there as a full team. We actually did a day with the department.
Oh.
I think it was a day. And we got on quite well, actually, and they sort of moved a bit and came round. But they wouldn't ever want to be seen as needing help.
No.
So
no.
There were those types of schools, and quite a lot of the religious schools were like that. I say quite a lot. On the other hand, there were schools like, talking on the church school front, there was a school that Paula Bartley, come across Paula's name, with Hilary Bourdillon.
Mm.
Paula and Hilary have written quite a bit of stuff on women in history, but she was part of the women in history group. Paula went as head of history to Notre Dame, in Southwark, just by the opposite the Imperial War Museum.
Mm.
And the head teacher there was a radical nun, feminist nun, who'd been in the States for a year. And they started peace studies. And just going into that school as a church school was a revelation. It was just such a really... free-thinking and aggressively pupil-focused school across the curriculum. And it used to be the school that Kenneth Baker, because it was the nearest one to Westminster.
Dear.
But actually, he wasn't just... I mean, because it was good stuff, you know, it was not totally unhappy, but it was very interesting, actually. Mm. As, and so ILEA was such an eclectic mix. There were certain divisions that we didn't see a lot of because of where we were.
Mm.
Clapham, you know, we were quite accessible to Wandsworth and Lambeth, Westminster. So coming from Hackney was hard. And actually, towards the end, we used to come out and do stuff.
In school sites?
School sites or in teacher centres in...
Oh, there were subsidiary
there
teachers.
There were divisional
centres.
Every division,
right.
There were 10 divisional teacher centres. Mm. And it was just easy to get a room. And so I'd go across, going across to Greenwich or... You know, it could take hours to get across there.
So those were the other subject centres, basically, were going to?
Divisional teacher centre was... there were 10 divisions geographically,
yeah.
And each division had a teacher centre which was multi-purpose. And most of the... So, for example, if you had a team of primary advisory... each division would have primary advisory teachers who were multidisciplinary.
Oh, right.
So they wouldn't necessarily be history-focused.
No.
Or social science or geography, whatever. But there were always primary colleagues that your history... your advisory teacher could go and work with, or you could they could host a meeting. Or so, for example, in Hackney, towards the end, in Hackney, Sutton House, don't know if you've ever heard of Sutton House, National Trust, Tudor House, just down the road here, was about to be sold to developers for flats, and there was a local campaign, and National Trust was persuaded to keep it, and one of the things to do was to get... It was a building site, actually, at the time, because it had been architecturally architectural salvage thieves had taken out all the Tudor panelling and the fireplaces and stuff like that. So we held meetings. Tricia Lancaster, who'd gone to the National Trust from Ilia, she used to teach with me in Islington, she and I sort of worked in a pincer movement, really, in this part of London, and held meetings at Sutton House for teachers locally.
Mm. That's very good.
Come and do, you know, that's how we're going to use this house. So out of that came a sixth form summer school, looking at an archaeological, historical site, interpretation. How is it going to be restored? What, you know, policy and public policy and stuff like that, and careers in, you know, is that. I've got that stuff somewhere, actually. Now, that's a point. All the summer schools... I'm jumping around here.
That's right.
Summer schools, every summer for 2 weeks. Have you come across those?
No, haven't seen anything on your summer schools.
I haven't got the stuff. I don't know whether I've got any stuff about these. I wish I did. The archive ought to have... Because there was a centrally produced programme. So somewhere, somebody may have it. But every subject inspectorate... across the authority, put on across 2 weeks in July summer schools for sixth form students. And the practice, and I think, I don't know whether it was general, but for us, for history and social sciences, we modelled mutual working between academics or museum curators or whoever and teachers. We saw it as an inset
for teachers
opportunity
as well.
For both.
Yeah. Oh, for both. Yes.
Well, both in terms of, well, particularly the museum people, actually, because museum services then were pretty random.
Mm.
Some very good, but not terribly informed by what teachers needed them to be doing.
Yeah.
So we just saw it as an opportunity for bringing them two together. They jointly planned and delivered. The museums gave their services free. We paid, this is horrendous, we paid £25. If you know, was it £25 for the week or was it £25 for a day? But it wasn't very much for the teachers for preparation.
Mm.
I ran 12 summer schools on £1,100.
Great.
That included student travel.
That's a real bargain, isn't it?
Incredible.
Yes.
And that's what, you know, this was profligacy as far as the government was, you know, it's one of the issues, spending all this money. £1,100 and 12, and there would be 20 students. We did 3 at the British Museum, 3 at the Tower, 3 at the Museum of London, 1 at Coalbrookdale, residential, fabulous, really, really good. I did the first one as a teacher down that, and before I went to the centre. And what else did we do? Imperial War Museum. Did I say that?
No.
Two there.
Other subject centres, like science, would be really more on their own as well.
Yeah, yeah. Huge programme. Mm. So every sixth form student across the authority technically had access to a sixth form summer school. Mm. At least one. Some of them did too, if they could get, you know, if they could get a place at the time.
Yes.
Yeah, so I used to go for two weeks of the year in my car with boxes. In those days you could park easily and you could, you know, I'd go around with resources and check out if everybody was okay, help out, do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They were tremendous. And so all the advisory teachers would actually participate in more of them. So we had ancient Egypt, ancient Greece. We had, and the whole thing was enrichment.
Mm.
They were not encouraged to do their A-level syllabus, linked one. They were encouraged. They could do. I mean, they weren't stopped. So, for example, the Imperial War Museum, they did a First World War and a Second World War one, usually. Or they would take particular types of... I mean, I remember one that majored on photographs in their archive. And could photographs lie? And looking at propaganda and looking at how photographs had been doctored and stuff at the time. And the one that we did at Sutton House, we did as Iliad died, so I think Iliad finished, but we did it with schools around.
Something 1990?
Was, I think, 1990. But we modelled it totally on
what you'd done before.
What we'd done before.
Yeah.
Using that as a site. Yeah. We've done stuff in palaces as well. And what, I mean, another course, actually, just thinking about another significant course, not that happened while I was there, but I attended as a teacher just before I went to the centre that Carol Adams set up, was a course, a week. Can you imagine this now? As a teacher, I spent a week at Kew in the archives with Alice Prochaska, who was then the archivist, and Carol. I don't know how many of us there were. And we could research absolutely anything we wanted to get sources to use back in school. So I can remember doing stuff around medicine, but I did. I then got hooked into records for transportation and I can't remember. I went off in a completely different direction. But it was a fascinating week, and it was, again, it was mutual centre plus public records. Let's see what we can do.
Yes. So you really, the centre's acting as a sort of catalyst for using all the resources available in London.
That's how I would say it, see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But equally, you know, we'd put on bog standard stuff, you know. Do you want to better your knowledge on X? So we would have people come and do, we'd have academics come and do teachers' sessions at the end of the day for A level. So I can remember a friend of mine actually coming and doing one, Donald Sassoon, or Mussolini. And we'd have a meet the examiners every year. All the boards would come and they would do an analysis of that year's examinations. What else? We would go for a week without anything formal. It wasn't something absolutely every, but I wouldn't say there were many weeks when there wasn't something happening that brought a group with a register and, you know, evaluation and all that stuff happening.
They didn't bring pupils to the centre.
They did the sixth form.
Sixth formers, yeah.
Yeah, they would bring, you know, we'd have maybe a dozen sixth form groups of, maybe they weren't huge in those days, they were sort of six or seven kids maybe. We brought them down for particular things where you wanted to demonstrate, for them to talk about stuff they were doing. We did use them sometimes, but not. It wasn't a huge. It wasn't like having them in a school. When we moved, did you come across this? We had to move about a year before the end of Ilya.
From Clapham?
Yeah, they wanted to sell the building to make money.
Mm. So where did you move to?
We moved to the Charlotte Sharman Primary School, which is opposite the Notre Dame School I was describing, next door to the Imperial Museum on St George's Square. And we had the top floor of this triple decker with geography. And so for the, at the very end, we came together with geography. And there we had your classic, you know, large, huge hall and classrooms around the edge, some of which were offices. We put the library. I'm trying to see where we put the library. Isn't that funny? Because we had to bring the geography library in as well. I mean, it was heaving with stuff. That all went to Tower Hamlets too. And that was the period leading up to the national curriculum. So we had a big conference in that hall on a Saturday for anybody who was interested in talking about the national curriculum.
Who did you have speak at it?
I expect we had John Slater. I can't remember. I think we had John Slater. Actually, I can't remember. Because he'd gone by then, hadn't he? And Hennessy was in the driving seat. But I was involved with the national curriculum. I wasn't on the working group. And we didn't have anybody from our group on the working group, but Chris Colpin was. And he was hugely part of our life, even though didn't you come across Chris?
Oh, yes, I've interviewed him.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think where he was teaching at that time.
He wasn't teaching. He'd left teaching, but he was living in Suffolk.
Right.
And he was working on the CSE in those days for the East Anglia Board. And he did move down to Somerset somewhere during that period. He may have been in Somerset by then.
Yeah.
But we brought him in, and he was hugely enthusiastic. I left him out of the equation, I don't know why, for the Mode 2 development.
Right, yeah.
World history,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And actually, he was writing those, and he was examining at the time as well, but his textbooks date from those days. You know the Brown book?
Yeah.
Whatever it was, Modern World Tests. I've got two of them upstairs, actually, somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sort of brick-like cover.
It's about that shape. Yeah. More smaller, yeah. So Chris was on the working group, but then and then Ian Colwell left and went into QCA, SEC, and Nick Tate was up at the NCC, and they needed to put together a task group for putting the order together out of the working group.
Right, yeah.
So I was asked to do that, but I was in Enfield by then. I'd only just gone there in the December.
So you were putting together the task group, or you were on the task group?
I was on the task group.
Yeah.
So I was part of the group putting together the order.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that period was when the centre was in Charlotte Sharman, where we had the space to have this big conference, and I do remember it was a huge one, where we were looking at how we were going to argue the case for this, that and the other. I mean, in the event, I think the national curriculum for history came out okay, you know,
so
under
you were,
the circumstances.
You were asking, sort of consulting people in the audience about what they wanted to see in the national curriculum, and then were you feeding that into...
No, this was when we were a pressure group.
Right. Yeah, so you were writing letters and stuff
It was that sort of, you know, it was an agitational conference as opposed to... well, constructively so, yes. I hope. And I don't know whether I've got anything from from those days. I mean, the other tragedy... I mean, you'll think I'm absolutely chaotic as an archivist here. I don't throw anything away. But I can't keep it here. But I've lost two lots. The other lot, I had the whole archive for the national curriculum. Task group, all the minutes, everything. And I lent it, I let it out of my possession. It's some box files and stuff, to Rob Phillips. And he did his book.
Yeah.
And then he died, didn't he? And I just didn't think it was appropriate
to ask for it back.
I don't know how you go about getting stuff back.
Yeah.
I might try Swansea, actually. Because I don't know what he did with it. He sent me a book. I mean, I've seen it since.
Yeah.
I had seen him since. I got it, my copy of the book, with... hope you recognise some of the stuff in here. Because I mean, Ian and Chris would have given him, you know, he had stuff from all of us, you know, quietly, and just did his PhD and stuff. And
Andy Reid has given me a lot of stuff.
Has he? Yes, he was on the same group. Yeah. That's right.
So I have got all that. Yeah, and I've also got working group stuff from various people who were on it. So
yeah, you're fine. You'll be fine with all that.
I wanted to sort of take you back to some questions which were popping into my head while you were talking about the centre. About the lower school provision, because you talked a lot about the GCSE, CSE and the A-level, but for lower secondary, what sort of things did you provide for them?
Well, that was really where most of the advisory... I would say there was a balance between the advisory work, actually, between the two. Because a lot of the teachers' material and the sharing and all the rest was lower secondary. And we did a lot of work around mixed ability teaching.
Yeah, because that was that something in ILEA that was recommended or was it,
was
just a particular school
orthodoxy
it?
Of sorts.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it was recommended for officially, to be honest. I but in history we were really, really strongly advocative of that. And if you've talked to Chris about this, it may not be significant in his memory as mine, but one of the other things we did before the common papers were developed, we had to prove and demonstrate that it was doable in history.
Yes.
And this had to had its knock on subsequently with tiering or not tiering. And I can remember taking Sean Garrett from the London O-level board to East Anglia to meet Chris and Angela Leonard. I don't know whether Angela was there then, I don't remember, but certainly Chris. And we looked at papers together. We looked at CSE and GCSE scripts. We looked at the questions. And Chris had done some thinking beforehand. And we sold Sean
the view that, yes,
he was against it. He was wholly against it until he went up on that trip, I remember. Yeah. And at the same time, we worked a lot with other centres and other colleagues. Two significant ones. One was with Webber Street, which was CP Centre for Primary CP something or other education.
Was that an ILEA?
It was an ILEA centre, and it was down next to in Waterloo, just near the old. Young Vic. Gosh, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, people who worked with special needs, who were hugely knowledgeable and experienced, were advisory people there. And each division had its own special needs advisory person too. So we worked with them to look at slower learners, or whatever we want to call them. Kids who are having difficulties. And we also worked with CUES, Centre for Urban Environmental Studies. Urban... Gosh, do you know, isn't it awful?
That's all
memory.
Right. That's all right.
Anyway, they're at Tower Hamlets, and that's where the EAL language, the second language stuff, was also really well-resourced. And there was a third person who's still going, who's Stuart Scott, of the Collaborative Learning Project. He's a one-man band, and he was an ex-English teacher, advisor from ILEA. And that was looking at working mainly with language learners, but it worked so well for special needs too, where group work, where through talk, looking at conceptual learning through talk. And that worked across all subjects. But when I was in school at Islington Green, we worked with him for our kids. And so we sort of applied all of that to... We incorporated it into the history curriculum. So this is actually came out just before I arrived at the centre. So it was already fairly well-established in... in the work of the centre.
Yeah.
And we just carried on, really.
So that's the whole focus on special needs teaching.
Well,
history,
it was on
mixed ability.
Mixed ability.
Yes.
We also did some high achieving stuff as well, but not so much as we were most concerned with language. Really, we were looking at language because there was, you know, hundreds of languages in our schools and how best to tackle it. It went hand in hand with content issues as well.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that because obviously you have to think about what's suitable content when you've got so many different children
and
with different heritages.
That conference for the national curriculum, I remember a major part of that was criteria for selecting content and who are our children and what are their needs and what is their experience and so on and so forth.
Had you come to some conclusions about that, you know, earlier in the life of the centre?
Yeah.
Because obviously there must have been big changes in London going back into the 60s
right,
and
the 70s. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. And I guess our mission was actually getting people, everybody else, to think about it and to have it on their radar. But again, it's going back to that issue about rationale. Mm. In a sense, for us, it wasn't so important what you did, it's that you had a reason for doing it. I think it was our liberal position. There was an agenda espoused, I guess, by quite a lot of us that, you know, it was really important for 20th century history to feature for obvious reasons. Mm. And Holocaust history, and we did a lot of work with the Imperial Museum because they were quite nearby, a really good relationship there. Mm. So and also there was a lot of work going on the Holocaust front in the 80s. There was some woman, what's her name? I remember, probably know her. It was up in the northeast, Eleanor. But people were doing research for their own purposes, and the Jewish Museum set itself up or moved into a new premise. I can't remember. There was quite a lot going on there. I mean, that's the other thing, actually. Public events, museums would publicise through us and they to get people coming coming to stuff.
So teachers would take school groups along?
Yeah. Or we would run things in museums with them.
So I wanted to ask you about the Afro-Caribbean side of things, and also Asian kids coming into inner London.
Yeah.
So did schools start to ask for a variety of different resources to cater for children with these heritages?
Yes, yeah. And people who were trying to put together resources came to see if we had anything. That's where we would pull out stuff that had really happened. So, for example, Maureen, in the school she was in, which was Hampstead, before she came to the centre, had done a really big unit on Arawaks and the Caribbean and early sort of looking at shell middens and the archaeology side and looking pre-colonisation and so forth. Jane Woodall in her school, which was Vauxhall Manor, had worked with social sciences, and Elise Dodgson, who was the drama teacher in the school. And they did this huge unit on people on the move, called People on the Move, which I wish I had. Yeah. That I have left, I'm sure, in Enfield. Which looked at Celts and Romans movement within, and then looking through into Saxon. Looking at people on the move historically, and then looking at people on the move today and then. And it coincided eventually at the end of the period. I mean, they'd been doing it in the early 80s. In the late 80s, early 90s, Museum of London did the Peopling of London. But that, there's another person actually associated with the centre, and she came at the very end to do my job for the last term, I think, was Rosina Visram. Do you know Rosina?
No, I don't.
She's well retired now. She's quite a lot older than I am. She was at head of department in Eltham Green School. SHP teacher. Ugandan Asian by origin. And always researching and and she came across fabulous stuff at the India Record Office.
Mm.
Through her, we did one of our summer schools there. But through her work, she ended up writing a book called Ayahs, Lascars and Princes.
Oh, right.
About Indian women coming over with white families, being paid for over here, but then being shipped into a hostel for homeless women in just up the road here, actually, in Hackney. And they had to find their own way back. Lascars down in Limehouse and on the docks, and then Princes, you know, basically. Mm. It's a nice book.
Mm, nice idea, isn't it?
It's probably somewhere in my collection. Mm. And she's also done some school books, but she was part of the curriculum development side of things that I was talking about earlier on the Mode 2, helping, you know, yeah. She had some knowledge. I've lost my thread, actually. Why did I go off on her tack?
Because, well, we're talking about...
Peopling of London.
Yeah.
That's right. She was the person who the museum, Docklands Museum, picked up on very early on in their inception when they had their double-decker bus that used to go around, trundle around. And she helped them think about their exhibition. And that's when she was doing her Lascars research. And she's done a lot more since, I think. I don't know what she's up to now. I think she's doing weaving or pottery or something. Mm. But she's still around. I still hear from her each year. We try to meet up, but we don't do it very often. But she would be very interesting as quite a long-term teacher.
Yeah, from that background.
From that background, yeah. Looking at how things were. And in many ways, she was quite conservative. Do you know what I mean? She was tentative about what she did, and very thoughtful, very conservative in a political sense, but cautious, but thoughtful. And she was teaching with a multi-ethnic population, as indeed we all were. The Afro-Caribbean thing was always much more fraught, I think.
Mm.
And I guess we did. That's where the political education thing became quite interesting, really, because we worked on projects as well. Somebody would come along and say, we've got this bit of funding to do X, would you work with us? So I can remember Julia Feen, who was at one point the political education advisor, or a teacher, working with the Anti-Slavery Society, contemporary, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so out of that came a sort of set of resources, and we had the Afro-Caribbean archive set up in Brixton, worked with them. We tried to do it in that way. We did, you know, we tried to sort of hook up. We did. I remember we did a session for oral history, using oral history, and we had four Afro-Caribbean service people who were prepared to come and talk, and they'd made a video, and they came and we used that type of community-based stuff.
Yeah.
Age Exchange we worked with a lot. Do you know them?
No. No.
They're a theatre company that work with the elderly, and they're based in Blackheath, and they have a shop. Last time I saw it, they have a sort of meeting centre, which is set out like a photographer, like, you know, I think it's a historically early century photographers, with artefacts and so forth, but they have full-time, I think they're still going, they've produced wonderful books with oral testimony around themes.
Mm.
And some of their most successful work would be to go into an old person's home, interview people about something in their past. And they did one around Afro-Caribbean elders, and the passport was the centre, and they... And what they would then do is they'd come back to the centre and they'd construct a play, which they would then take back to the elderly community and perform.
Oh, well.
And then they'd get more memories. That would trigger more memories, and they'd accrue a lot of material that way. And occasionally, they'd do with the local schools. So they'd bring school students into the old people's home or the other way round. They do the play to them together, and then the kids would interview the elders, and that way they were fabulous. And so we hooked into that, you know, worked with them, really, and just basically into exploiting We didn't have a lot of money. We had a very relatively small budget. So we sort of sparked on what there was that we were aware of.
I came across a review of your budget, actually.
Did you?
In the LMS.
Yeah, you're not very good at it.
No, it wasn't that. I was very cautious.
It was
towards the end of Ilya, and I think they were saying how much we were spending on all these centres, so it listed all the centres, showed how much they were spending on them.
I mean, they had to spend on rates and on, you know, all that stuff, and there were salaries. In terms of what money we had to spend, we ran things on a shoestring. And I remember that the mayor, I always see this as a gender issue, I used to go to the warden's meetings, and the men were so much better at wheeling and dealing than ever I was. And I don't know how much...
Did you used to have to go in and argue for your budget for
the year? No, we had a group. You know, we'd be talking about what initiatives were coming up and what we were going to do.
What do you mean by wheeling and dealing?
No, they'd have ways of working the budget, spinning it, you know. I don't mean fraudulently.
No.
But actually... I did absolutely everything by the book. How do they manage to do all this? I can't... They just had... I don't know how they did it. Anyway, all I'm saying is I was quite cautious about it. See, these are the... these are some of the divisional centres. Isledon was Islington. Gordon Centre was in Greenwich.
I've come across that one.
These are the wardens.
Yeah.
These are the people who were doing the session, actually.
The divisional centres, did they have wardens as well, or was it just advisory teachers based?
No, they all have wardens. Right. Centre for Urban Educational Studies is Kews.
Mm.
And they've moved, Rahana Minas, that's right, they've moved them down to Lambeth. They used to be in, or maybe they had an outpost down in Tower Hamlets.
You've got videos and things there. Were you recording a lot of the training you were doing so it was available to people at the times? So
not much, actually. No, we did have camera. We invested in a camera. I mean, this was really quite hard times. I remember investing in Do We Dare by, you know, an early form of this, you know, could we afford it?
Yeah.
It that sort of thing.
The videos
really
were remarkably expensive, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, we did work with the video unit for Ilya, and we went into schools and we filmed teachers teaching, and they were available. Right. So, for example, Hilary Bordillon, one of the first things I did, it was already scheduled, it wasn't my idea. We were making a video at Sedge Hill School of Hilary Bordillon teaching medicine to her students. And I had to work with the camera crew. I mean, it was incredibly impressive. Three cameras in the room, sound stuff going on, you know, and how they did it was really professional. And we did that periodically across the time I was there, and I don't have them, unfortunately. They would have been in the collection at Tower Hamlets, and whether they've survived or not, I don't know. But we kept a collection of videos that we lent to people.
Yeah.
We copied for them. We could copy. Red Skirts on Clydeside. See, that was something we came across. I don't know how we came across it. It was a Sheffield women's group, a woman doing research on this rent strike in Glasgow during the First World War. And they did a video for it. And they came down, for this Women's History Week, they came down and talked. Showed the video and talked about it.
Mm.
And that was just something, you know, you came across it. And I used that with A-level students subsequently because it was oral testimony, it was history around us.
Yeah.
You know, all of that stuff. Just thinking about... And Bea Campbell came and did...
Oh, right.
She'd just written... She was a friend of mine, and was at the time. I mean, I don't hardly ever see her now, but I did see her in the 80s, and she'd just written Wigan Pier Revisited, and it was a Women's History Week. Why did she come and do that? So that was looking at, again, information in public and private domains.
During the time...
It's 89, that's the last...
During the time you were at the centre... Could I borrow that?
The first year was 85. I mean, this is going.
Yeah.
Well, there's industrial action. Teacher industrial action. Ilya response. Mm. Focus on women. That's our letter. Our letterhead.
Right, very nice. I wondered if during the time you were there, there were any sort of major shifts in what people were asking for? Or did you have an annual sort of survey of what people wanted?
Yeah, I started, it didn't exist before I went, but I did start doing it. I did a sort of questionnaire thing that went out to all departments. Yeah. Didn't necessarily get a huge response. I don't remember how good it was.
Yeah.
But, and we did try to, you know, we used it, but we then still put in what we could get hold of. I used to go and do the odd thing like that. I went out to Norwich.
Some of these other places had teacher centres for history, didn't they? Cambridge had one.
Well, not many did.
No.
Kent did subsequently, because Ian Coulson, who you may have met, came to see me, as did Andy Reid. They were both advisory teachers. Andy was in Norfolk.
Yeah.
And then he went to Staffordshire. And Ian was in Kent, and they both wanted to set up centres similarly, and Ian actually did.
Mm.
But of course, he's had a terrible time in Kent, and is still having a terrible time in Kent. Mm. So I don't know what's happened there.
I'd love to photocopy that actually, because it's a really good illustration. Because it says this will be the first ever meeting devoted to addressing this important issue, and this is 1988. So
that's right.
Yeah.
I hope you don't mind. I'm collecting lots of paper. I can photocopy stuff upstairs.
Can you?
That's lovely.
Oh, that's great.
That's age exchange. That's what I was looking for.
That's age exchange.
And we used to use, this is the first one, we did resources guides. Look at these. The first Women's History Week in 85. We produced, that's the programme. And we got all public libraries across Ilia.
Mm.
Well, they didn't all do something, but we asked them all to. Yeah. Anybody, we wrote to all the museums. And the whole week had stuff, and actually either side of it. What the multi-purpose teacher centres did, specialist teacher centres other than ours. So I can't remember. Q's did something. Exhibitions and displays in libraries and stuff, theatre groups, follow-up activities, Museum of London, Tower of London, London Transport Museum. It just goes on. It's a lot of contact. And then we did resources to go with it for schools.
Mm.
All the addresses for...
Do you know how many schools participated in that sort of event? That's the difficult one, isn't it?
Difficult. They did. A lot of them did assemblies.
Mm.
You know, it sort of went from modest things to people, and people came to events during the week, and then they perhaps went back and did something that we didn't hear about. You know, it was a sort of pump priming type activity. We just thought, let's have a go at this. So it came from the American sort of experience that we'd got, and I have got those materials upstairs. I rescued those because I knew nobody else was going to be interested in them. And there was a wonderful American woman from California, from Berkeley, who was about 70, who was working with another woman called Lynn Reese in California on women's history and putting together events and resources.
Mm.
And she would come over and come and see us and look at what we were doing. And when my first sort of trip to America in 80... It was 85, actually. I went to see her in her Californian home. And she's now dead, very sadly, not surprisingly.
Yes, she's already aged then.
She was a fantastic inspiration to doing this type of thing, really. So we then, each year, we changed the title from Women's History Week to focus on women to make it more generic.
Yeah.
But we kept ours as history. And it sort of, it was, we couldn't sustain, really, that level of activity each year. We did our best, and you see Women's History through Reminiscence, Age Exchange, Reminiscence Theatre at Blackheath Village, Day Course, 8th of March, 88, Practical and Theoretical Approaches to Working Through Older People's Memories and Enriching the Curriculum Through Exchange of Values, Ideas and Experiences.
It's trying to sort of not ghettoise it too much, does it? Bring it into, mixing it into oral history or other parts of history.
Yeah, that was our position, really. You know, don't go for the token gesture.
Mm.
There was a set of books as well that came out of the Women in History group, which Hilary Wynne-Walpole were part of and Carol Adams, they were already in the publishing mode when I went to the centre, so they were early 80s. And that, again, they were working with academics or people doing their own research. So, for example, Angela John was doing her coal mining women stuff.
Yeah.
That came out as a children's book, well, Key Stage 3 book, really, effectively lower secondary. There was one on medieval knights and, what was it called, Black Book. It came out at Cambridge University Press. There were about six of them came out in the period I was there, so those clearly we incorporated. And then there were a few other books that we collaborated on. MacDonald, I remember, wanted to do a series on women. Local, national and international in each book. I've got one of those books upstairs. There'd be a British, a local or individual and then a set of individuals working at national and then an international context, worldwide. Gosh, I remember women history makers, women history makers, right. Set. And subsequently, of course, once all this was over and I'd gone, I was in Enfield, then I worked with John Murray and Jim Belbin on Women Through Time. In that series for SHP, Key Stage 3, which is now out of print, very sadly.
A lot of stuff is because you're changing the curriculums.
Well, that's because they don't sell a lot. People would buy a copy. I went into a school in Lambeth, though, joyously, 2 years ago to do some work on assessment for learning, and the stock cupboard had two class sets. it just depended, really. You needed to keep the momentum going, and that's what the end of India did, really.
Do you think that people buying the books just to photocopy them, so they'd only bought the old one?
Or they put it in, insert it into something else they're doing. Yeah. Which, you want them to do.
To do with how much it permeates what people are actually doing.
Yeah.
Could you get any impression about the impact of the centre at school level? Obviously, you could, at the end of the year, you were counting on how many people have participated in training, etc., and that would go in your report. But
it's funny, it's very interesting at the moment because there's you and there's Simona that are sort of triggering me. It's very nice, on one level it's therapeutic, really, to be able to talk about it. And I've mentioned it to the odd person, I guess, who are usually people who would use the centre. But there are people who I've come across more people since I've been freelance. From Ilya, or it's turned out that they were in Ilya at the time. And they said, we don't know what we'd have done without. So from individuals who knew the centre, you get incredibly strong, good feedback. I think you see, for 150 secondary schools, you could probably say somewhere between 15, 20 and 30, I don't know, 20 to 30, let's say, a fifth, probably made heavy use of the centre, one way or another. Then you'd have another fifth who maybe had contact once a year or something like that. And I don't know, this is purely conjecture. I just don't know. You'd have a school where both history and social sciences work together strongly, and so would, and they'd have a tradition of carrying on. So, I could probably do a job on it, actually, get the green book and get the whole list of all the schools and go through and do a calculation of how many of them stick in my memory as being regular users. I could do that for you if it was helpful. I could equally do the same that we never, saw in our lives. Or So I don't know.
No, I mean, I don't want to put you into any trouble about that at all. Well, and of course, it's unscientific.
It is unscientific.
But then oral history is a bit unscientific. Mm. You know, I'm going on your
own. I know, I'm remembering the stuff that I remember, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's an awful lot that's falling out, probably falling out through the cracks.
But there's some really significant things there, because what you're demonstrating by some of the things you're saying is the wider impact of the centre, for instance, on GCSE or on other centres or practice elsewhere in different parts of the country.
I think we had quite a significant impact on quite a lot, you know, and all of the developments subsequent, I think we have on the national curriculum. Through, you know, through just through Chris's association with us going into the working group.
Yeah.
In the task group we did, undoubtedly, but not only was Ian there, in an official role, and you know he played it by the book. It wasn't, and I was the only Ilya person in there. But it was good that, and I wasn't, you know, I was there because I was Enfield, of course, covertly. But yes, I think, you know, for example, you would never have got. I will say this, and maybe anybody else who was there, and Andy was there at the time, might say, I don't remember that. I think that there was a non-European unit in Key Stage 2, because I was there, and it was the Ilya experience that was speaking there.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't in the task group's recommendations at all. I remember Nick Tate saying, OK, convince me that there should be some non-European history at Key Stage 2. So I remember Doug Thorburn, who was HMI at the time, and I think Andy was part of it. There was a small group of us went away, and we marshalled an argument for doing that. Mm. And he said, "Right, I will now take this to the, you know, minister and see what I can't promise." Didn't he? He didn't expect to get it passed at all, but it did.
It is
right. So although it's indirect,
indirect.
I don't think it would have happened. Without, and I'm not saying it's me personally. I know that, you know, Catherine Ross, who came into the job with me in 83 as advisory teacher for history, had a really strong background in African history. She studied at SOAS, I think, and she'd done quite a lot of research, and she'd done some work for resources that we provided there. She, for example, went and found out about Mary Prince and wrote that up into a little teacher's resource. So that's what the advisory teachers were doing in their own, you know, on their own sort of behalf. And she was really familiar with Benin, and she'd been working with the Museum of Mankind for summer schools and so forth. And you just, you know, you just felt, is this wealth of stuff?
Yeah.
And it's important to have it in there. So Benin, I think, wouldn't have gone in without that argument. You know, then we had to come up with six examples. Do you remember?
Examples, yeah.
And I mean, they were off the top of your head, actually. I mean, I wouldn't pretend that it was the best set, but and I sort of come out of the summer schools. You know, Egypt. We always did an Egypt one. We did the Benin, we'd used the bronzes for the Museum of Mankind. The Maya, we had had something on that. I'm not saying they were wholly that, but I'm just saying, well, you could, for example, have such and... I could do a rumour to do... You could, for example, just do such and such. Now, I'm not an expert on this, but... and, of course, that's how decisions happen, really.
Yeah. Yes.
Accident theory of history, really.
Well, you've answered a question for me, because I was actually asked how Benin had got in there.
Yeah, that's how that was.
And Andy hadn't remembered. I asked him. So, excellent. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah. Benin was one. What else did we... that was the main one, because then people were saying, why have we got Benin? And I thought, oh, God, how awful. Anyway, one of the things we did do, subsequently, when Sue Bennett went into Nick's job for the NCC... She had the job of making materials to support the national curriculum. I was in Enfield by now, but only just. And she was videoing, she was doing a video which had on it the non-European study unit. And she asked me if I would do something to be videoed. Now, although I'm in Enfield, this is wholly centre thinking. I said, well, I thought what would be good would be to go to the British Museum and work with the experts from Museum of Mankind on Benin and Egypt from the British Museum.
Mm.
And we had, I took, now was it 12 teachers or 20? I took a captive audience of teachers from Enfield down to the British Museum Education Centre. And we ran a day that was videoed of two groups working in the galleries with the experts, but also on sources in the centre. And Benin was to be the target because Sue wanted to, you know, it was the place where we needed to do most.
It was the most obscure to most teachers. Yeah.
So we ran this day as a course, as we would have done at Clapham. And at the end of the day, we didn't tell the teachers it had a bias in it. We did exactly even-handedly for the Egyptian teachers and the Benin ones. And at the end of the day, we had a discussion, a debrief, where I just took from both groups how the day had gone and what they'd got out of it and how they'd, and what they were going to do when they got back. And this isn't on the video, but it was the most powerful bit of the day. The Benin people were completely bowled over by their day, and they got the most out of it, and they were amazed at what they'd understood and what they thought they could do back in school. And the Egyptian teachers had really enjoyed it, but a completely different experience because they had gone into it with baggage.
Yes, well, of course, because they'd have a background, yeah.
And of course, there was so much more stuff, in a way.
Yeah.
And they had found it much harder to pick their way through it to see how they'd deal with.
Mm.
Whereas the Benin people, we'd set it up with stuff around the natural curriculum and you know, concepts and skills and stuff at the beginning. So they sort of were applying things to what they were doing. And it was a really, really good discussion. And I said to Sue, that would be so good to show because it's so powerful about how... But it didn't, probably didn't make it because it wasn't what the day was about. It was actually to look at some of the Benin stuff. And then, of course, other agencies took Benin and put together packs and so forth. So, yeah, it was interesting aside.
Yes, no, it is interesting that. And Sue Bennett, had she worked with the centre before?
Not really. I didn't know Sue very well at all. I got to know her through... She was in Warwick then, working on ICT, wasn't she? Before she went. She was working on ICT.
All right. I don't know her, I have to be honest.
Have you not met her?
Yeah, I met her very briefly at a seminar.
Well, she became quite a figure, and I think it was through the HA, quite a lot through the HA, and she got taken up by, she got the job at NCC to take her, and then, of course, she became a very strong presence. I don't quite know where she came from, what her previous, she must have been a history teacher before. And so she was history subject officer at NCC, and she did quite a lot of the support, non-statutory guidance
that was
material. And then she went to QCA, and she stayed on there, stayed in as QCA, and she retired a couple of years before me. She's probably gone about 5 years. And she works freelance now, but she's still quite strong in the HA and the Council for Europe. She does quite a lot of the international stuff. Yeah.
That's a wonderful run through the whole impact and development of the History Teachers Centre.
Stream of consciousness.
Well, I've got an enormous amount of information out of that. I've just switched this off. You're probably